what I was going to talk about this afternoon was a continuation of what we talked about last time, which was a discussion of the covenants of God. And, you know, just to get us started here, you know, Hosea says that my people perish for lack of knowledge. And when you look at Christianity today and you think about the things that they have very little knowledge about, those are really, as we go through the Torah studies every week, we realize that these are the things that people really need to know in order to understand Messiah. For instance, the sacrifices. I mean, most people in Christianity don't have the foggiest idea what the sacrifices were about or anything like that. And so they misapply what little information they do have and then miss the mark. And it's the same thing with so many different things. And I would submit to you that most people in Christianity today don't have really the foggiest term of what a covenant or idea of what a real covenant is about, and how God used the covenants in a specific way in order to give His people hope for a future that they wouldn't otherwise have. And when I started this study, you know, this has been actually a number of years that we've been sort of touching on this, but it's been a tremendous blessing for me just to be able to study and realize these things, because as you study these things, you become more solid in your understanding of God and what He is going to do for us individually, but as a people also. And when it comes down to the covenant relationship we have with God, we have a personal relationship, but we really have a corporate relationship too. And as we look through the Hebrew and see how God worked with the Hebrew people, we realize that God just as concerned about all Israel as He is about every individual person. And so if we could get into the concept of looking corporately at things, it would help us to understand the overall plan of God and what He's doing. So anyway, let's go on in then to this. And we do have a lot to cover, so I'm going to ask you to keep your questions and write them down, and we'll do all the questions at once in the end so that we can try to get through this and get through the flow. This particular talk, I gave it down in Tyler last time I was down there, and this one here caused a lot of problems, and because of that, I'm not going to give the last part of this. So, no, serious. No, I'm not going to give it because we don't have time. It took me an hour and 45 minutes to do it down there. And so we're going to break this in half and we'll give the next one next time. The other half next time. So you just get the beginning of it. So what we're going to do, some of you weren't here last time, so we'll review what we did last time. We basically took the last session to define what a covenant was. And we learned that covenant is a Hebrew word, or that the Hebrew word for covenant is barit, which means a pledge, an agreement, or an alliance. It's a contract, but it's not really a contract. It's an agreement between people. And for those of us who have been in a marriage covenant, we realize that it's something that's supposed to be solid and something that is not easily forsaken, and something that when the parties go into it, they don't go into it with the intent of it dissolving. You always intend for it to last forever. And we also know that by our own vows that we took when we were married, that it is till death do us part, right? Well, this is not something that we came up with just on our own. This is not a Christian concept. This is a God concept, that covenants last forever, and the only thing that breaks covenants is death. We learned that in regards to the covenants that God makes, there is an aspect of love involved in them that are not necessarily a part of what you might consider man-made covenants. And the aspect of love is what separates a covenant from a contract. We learned also that through covenants, though covenants contain laws, covenants in themselves are not laws. And this is a very important key to understanding what a covenant is, because oftentimes we'll associate the new covenant with an aspect of law, which is different from the old covenant, we would say. And so You can have a change in covenant, or you can have a change in law within a covenant without changing the fact that you still have the same covenant. An example of this, I was talking to my son and his wife last night, Crystal and Jason, and an idea of this is that when people get married, they say, oh, we're going to have 15 kids, okay? And so this is part of their covenant. You know, we agree we want to have a big family. All right, so you have 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 kids, and you realize, oh, this gets expensive. And you may just say then, well, we're going to pare it down a little bit. We're going to stop at 5. All right, so making the change from wanting to have 15 kids down to having 5 kids doesn't do away with the covenant, does it? It's just a term of the covenant. One of the terms of the covenant has now changed. There are two types of covenants made between God and man. And the first one is a suzerainty covenant. And just quickly, a suzerain covenant. A suzerain is a large nation versus a vassal, which is a small nation. And a suzerainty treaty was when a large nation would agree to protect a small nation that was usually adjacent to it, had shared adjacent borders. But it didn't necessarily have to. And in return for the larger nation protecting the smaller nation agreed to certain terms. And if the smaller nation then failed to live up to the terms, then the large nation oftentimes would go in and first off try to convince the smaller nation to stick with the terms. But if not, then they would go in and crush the small nation. That's basically the way it would work. And we have examples of these types of covenant relationships that have been unearthed. Archaeologists in the last 50 years have done us a tremendous service in uncovering a lot of these ancient Hittite suzerain covenants that are models of what we see in the Bible. And they're in the same time frame and everything. So it's like God is all of a sudden in these last days, He's starting to reveal and open up all of this information to us. And, you know, it says in the Bible that knowledge will be increased at the last days. Well, this is some of the knowledge that's being increased, that we understand now what God was doing in regards to these covenants that he made with various persons down through history. So the first type is the suzerain covenant. That's there again, that's between a strong nation and a small nation. And the other is a parity covenant. Let me back up here. The suzerain covenant includes the cutting of the pieces, which we see in Genesis 15, where they walk between the parts. We'll talk a little bit about. Well, I can't really talk more about that right now. But in a suzerain covenant, it's the typical way to establish a suzerain covenant is that the king of the large nation and the king of the small nation would come together. They would sit down and eat a meal or whatever. But one of the things that was always included in that was that they would take an animal, cut it in half, lay it down, and then they would walk between it. And we see this in practically every one of these ancient Hittite suzerain covenants, this practice taking place, because that was the seal of the covenant. And what it basically said is that if I as the suzerain or if I as a vassal refuse or fail to live up to the terms of the covenant, then let happen to me what happened to these animals. And this is precisely what we see in Genesis 15. Now, the second type of covenant that we see is called a parity covenant. Oh, well, I forgot about this, too. The suzerain covenant usually had a covenant sign. This was also part of the parity covenants, and now I'm going to get down to it. Parity covenants are the second type of covenant we see, and that is basically in the form of marriage contracts. And what sets a parity covenant off from a suzerain covenant is that in a suzerain covenant, you got a strong king, and the strong king is going to the small king and saying, hey, I will offer to protect you. Or it could be the small king coming and asking for protection, but in all these cases, the strong king was the one who was set the stipulations. The little guy really had no power or no opportunity to say, this is what I want to do. It was always the large king, the big king, said, this is the way it's going to be. Where in a parity covenant, It was both parties, even though you had a strong king and a weak king, you had both parties coming together, and they would agree in a bilateral agreement. Both of them would say, well, I'll do this if you'll do this. And the guy, the big king would say, okay, I agree to that and all that. And so they would come in together with a bilateral agreement. But once they made the agreement, then the large king was always the one who was considered the one in charge in this deal. The bilateral portion of this only lasted during the negotiation period. Okay, and oftentimes in the case of a suzerain covenant versus a bilateral covenant, in a suzerain covenant, the small nation really had no choice but to enter into this thing. If they didn't enter into it, they were more than likely going to be crushed by another enemy. Whereas in a parity covenant, it was a situation where both parties wanted to come into this for the mutual good of the two. An example of this is King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. King Solomon, in this particular case, was obviously the greater kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. The Queen of Sheba was the Queen of Ethiopia, and they came together in a parity covenant, and he actually married her, and it was for the benefit of Ethiopia as well as Israel. Israel gained something out of this also, but in that situation, though, King Solomon was still the greater king, and he was the one basically in charge.
So why wouldn't that be a suzerain covenant?
Because she wasn't coming asking for protection. Okay, and then finally, by definition of the ancient covenant, or concept of cutting a covenant, the only way out of the covenant is death. So if a person simply wants to say, I don't want anything else to do with this covenant, the only way out of the covenant is death. Because they walk between the parts. Alright? So, let's move forward. What we're going to do is we're going to look at three covenants that God made early on in the Torah. And we're going to look at various aspects of these covenants. We're going to analyze them. We're going to determine who the parties were that were involved in the covenant, the purpose of the covenant. We're going to look at the covenant sign, if there was one, the duration of the covenant, when it was supposed to end, the requirements of each party, because within the covenant there are requirements. And if there were violations to the covenant, and how these violations were dealt with. And finally, is the particular covenant in existence today? And if so, are we a part of that particular covenant? So, the first covenant we want to look at is the covenant with Noah. In fact, this is the first defined covenant in the Bible. Now, some people will say the covenant, God made a covenant with all the earth back at the time of Noah, time of Adam. And I would support that view, but this is the first clearly defined covenant we see in the Bible. And since we know the story so well, I'm not going to go through it necessarily. But we know that as a result of the flood, God came to Noah and said that he would never again destroy mankind. That was the promise, that I will never again destroy mankind with a flood. And I think by saying that, since this was the only way God had ever destroyed the entire earth, we could assume that God is simply saying, I'm not going to destroy the earth anymore. Okay? Not at least in this age. We're not going to destroy the earth again. Another thing that God said is that the seasons would remain intact. There would always be spring, fall, and all that. And what was the purpose of that? For harvesting, gardening, and stuff. Okay? So God said that there would always be seasons. God also gave more food options to the people. And then God also set a token in the sky that the covenant was in existence. And we know what that token was. It was the rainbow, right? Okay. Now, I want us to think a little bit about the token of the rainbow. And I don't have the scripture written down here. No. But the token of the rainbow was given not for us necessarily. It was given for God. Because if you look at the scripture and read what it says that God says, I set the bow in the sky so that I will look at it and never again destroy the earth. So what it's basically stating is that God is saying that I don't care how ticked off I get, I'm never going to destroy the earth again. And anytime I think and anytime I'm tempted, because I am so mad at those people to destroy the earth, I'm going to look down there and I'm going to see that rainbow and I'm going to say, I'm under covenant. I can't do it. So God is under covenant. It's this sign in the sky for Him so that He won't break the covenant. You see? Now, what does it do for us? The rainbow for us is simply the assurance that God can't destroy the earth because He is under covenant. And by the way, the covenant of the rainbow is a unilateral covenant. We have nothing to do with that, right? And so God is 100% responsible for that, of not destroying the earth. And so we have this assurance. And what that assurance does, it gives us the understanding and the knowledge that things are going to go on. That God is not going to, that at the middle of the night, it's not going to start raining down hail and brimstone, and the earth isn't going to open up and start flooding with us. We know that's not going to happen beyond any shadow of doubt because we got God's word and we are under covenant, right? So when we look at that, we see the parties involved are God, Noah, Noah's descendants, and all, and the animals even. I mean, God made this covenant with everybody, including the animals. The purpose was to assure all involved that the earth will not be destroyed again by the flood. The covenant sign is the rainbow. The duration is forever. And the requirements is that God is to look at the rainbow anytime He's inclined to destroy the earth. And I bet He looks at that rainbow a lot. And so nowadays, when you look at that rainbow, you look at that, that's sort of a shield for us, you know? It's sort of a covering for us, you might say. Because as long as that rainbow's in the sky, we can rest assured God's not going to destroy us tomorrow. Okay? And then what is mankind's responsibility? None. We don't have a single responsibility in this covenant relationship. Because this is something God made unilaterally. Have there ever been any violations of it? No. There's never been a violation of this. And is it still valid? And most importantly, does it pertain to us? Are we glad we are under this covenant? Right. All right, so this is a good example of what covenants do for God's people and for all people, really. And so anybody, if you were to ever ask somebody, do they want to be under the covenant? And they say, well, we're not under covenant. And you say, well, what about the rainbow? Oh, yeah, we're under that one. Yeah. All right, because it's a good one, right? It's a good covenant.
Mm-hmm. But then He says, I'll never again destroy the earth
with a flood.
With a flood.
Okay, so let's move on. The next covenant we see is in Genesis 12. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is the basis for all Christian and Jewish beliefs. There's not a Christian out there that is not claim to be a worshiper of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it's the basis for our beliefs, and so we should know a little bit about this covenant, because this is an important one. It was developed over a period of years, and this covenant, when you look at the definition of covenants and define and to see the way that God or the Hittites define covenants, this began as a parity covenant and became a, what you might say, a suzerain covenant. But it's mostly a parity covenant. What I'm saying then is that God looked down at Abraham and He took a liking to Abraham. And He said, Abraham, I want to have a relationship with you. Abraham was not under duress. He was not threatened. He was not about to be killed or anything. In fact, you know, history sort of indicates that Abraham was a pretty powerful guy back in Ur of the Chaldees. There's nothing that would cause him to flee to God for safety. God took a liking to Abraham. Abraham had taken a liking to God. And so they took and formed a relationship. And as we know, from the Genesis 12, verse 3 account, it says that that the descendants of Abraham would become a great nation, that Abraham would have a great name. And there again, in just Judaism and in Christianity, he has a great name. Also in Islam, he has a great name. All nations are blessed, would be blessed by him, by this relationship that God was going to have with Abraham. And that those people who would bless Abraham by extension, the people of Abraham, the children of Abraham, would then themselves be blessed. And so this is a pretty good thing that God is starting to do with Abraham. This is a bilateral thing. God told Abraham to get out of your country and I'll do this. So if Abraham had not gotten out of the country, what would have happened? It wouldn't have happened, right? Okay, so there is requirements made of Abraham. It was bilateral. Abraham, you do this, I'll do this. You do this, I'll do this. Okay? So it was dependent upon Abraham actually doing something. And then God responding. So we go on down to Genesis 15. And God adds to the covenant. Now, at this time, the covenant really hadn't been clearly established. But here in Acts 15 is when we see the covenant clearly established. Abraham looks up at the stars and he says, I don't have any children. You know, you won't let Eleazar, my servant, fulfill the promise that you've made to me. So, you know, what's going on, God? And God says, okay, Abraham, you're going to have a child. The child's going to be he's going to be your son. He's not going to be someone else's son. He's going to be your son. And I'm going to establish a promise through him. And by the way, his children and his children's children and children's children and so on are going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky. And then also, this is where he says, and I'm going to establish the land, and he actually extends the borders of the land that God was going to give to Abraham. This is the point where we see the actual cutting of the covenant, where Abraham takes the 3-year-old bull, I think it is, and splits it in half, and he takes some birds and splits them in half, and then they walk down between the parts. But it's not they who walks between the parts. Who walks between the parts? Yahweh. It was Yahweh. Right. It wasn't Abraham because Abraham was asleep when this took place. So by that, we understand that at this point, this is a unilateral covenant. Uni, one. God alone is making covenant with Abraham. Now, why would he have done that? First off, it's because he told Abraham to leave, and Abraham did what he told him. And so, God is seeing from Abraham that he is willing to do as he's told. In fact, as we go on down in Scripture, when this covenant is passed on to Isaac, God tells Isaac, I've made this covenant with your father because your father obeyed my Torah, my mitzvah, my mishpah, whatever it is, all these different things that God had, basically all of God's laws and all of God's ordinances and all this, Abraham obeyed them. And so God said, okay, because of that, and because I know he's going to do that, that's why I can make this unilateral covenant with Abraham. And so that's precisely what he did. So, we go on now to Genesis 17. And here we see additions to the covenant. Now, remember, the covenant now is established, right? So, we would sometimes think, well, the covenants, because we look at covenants as contracts, we would say, well, he can't add now to the covenant. But he did add to the covenant. But because everything that he added was good stuff, we don't ever take and argue about that. But here we see a change in the stipulations of the covenant. So the change was that God was adding not more requirements, but he was adding more blessings to the covenant. And we see at this point that the descendants are to become many nations. And so Abraham's name was changed from Abram, which means father of Almighty, or Mighty Father, I think it means, and to Abraham, which means father of many nations. So his name is changed. He was told that the child is not going to come through just any woman. It's going to come through this woman, Sarah. And there's another extension to the land. And then we also see that the covenant is defined as an everlasting covenant. Everlasting covenant. So what this says is that, okay, I've made a covenant with you, Abraham. You're going to die someday. And when you die, this does not end the covenant. It's an everlasting covenant. This will go on forever and ever and ever. So we see these things added to the covenant. And then we see this really neat thing. All right? What did God do to prove that he was loyal to the covenant of Noah? He put a rainbow in the sky. All right? So here God does this. Oh, well. I guess this is what he does right here. He puts circumcision in as the sign of the covenant. Okay? Now, let's think about this for a second. Abraham was already under a unilateral covenant, right? What if Abraham had decided not to get circumcised? Was he still under covenant? Yeah, he was still under covenant. God had already established the covenant. He was already under covenant. It was after God had established the covenant that he established circumcision as a sign of the covenant. Abraham was, what, 75 years old? And God's saying, get circumcised? And Abraham just has to think here. I've already got all these promises. He's bound by these promises. He walked between these pieces. He's bound. He's got to do this. Do I really want to go out and get circumcised? And if I don't get circumcised, what's going to happen? Nothing. I'm still under the covenant. And he's still bound. But what did Abraham do? He ran to get circumcised. And not only did he run to get circumcised, he circumcised his entire household that day. His children, which is child at that time, and his entire household. Why did he do that? Because he wanted all of them to be under covenant. He wanted them all to have the sign of the covenant. So Abraham, who didn't have to do this, did this anyway. Because he wanted the sign of the covenant. The sign of the covenant is almost as important as the covenant. Just like the rainbow is just almost... I mean, the rainbow is what protects us from the wrath of God, you might say. And so we look at that sign and we say, oh, we're really glad that sign's up there. Same thing with circumcision here in this regards. It's the sign of the covenant. Thus, the sign of the covenant is nearly as important as the covenant. And Abraham jumped at the opportunity to do this, even though he was 75 years old. And then as we see in Genesis, it says, any uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. What this is saying then is that from this point forward, anybody who wants to be a part of the sign or a part of the covenant with Abraham has to wear this sign. Anyone who else wants to move from that point forward has to have that sign. So, and if not, he's going to be cut off from his people. And in ancient Israel, to be cut off from the people means you are separated out. Because Israel was a clan. They were a community type people. And if you were outside the community, you were subject to all the warriors and bandits and pirates and everything else that were out there. So it was important to not be cut off.
So this is what God says about circumcision in regards to the covenant. After this point, we go on to the Akedah. Let me see. Let me back up. We have the Akedah where the binding of Isaac, where God reaffirms the fact that Abraham, you know, I am so convinced that you would never turn against me, that, you know, this is a done deal. You don't have to worry about ever not being out of covenant with me, because I just know how good and how righteous you are going to be. And also, it's at this point then, after the Akedah, that God says, not only are your children going to be as the stars, they're going to be as the sand of the sea. And there's a lot more sand out there than there are stars, even though there's billions and billions and billions of stars. God also said at this point, after the Akedah, that Israel, or that Abraham's descendants would control the gates of their enemies, thus showing that Abraham's descendants would be strong nations, ruling nations, and there again the covenant is set. So, this next point, next slide here, is to show us, and I want to illustrate to us, the importance of one covenant and another covenant. And that is this: the covenants are nested within each other. And what I mean by nested is that you have this little nest here, and then inside this nest you have an egg, okay? And you can't have the egg really develop without the nest, right? All right, so let's look at this in regards to the covenant with Abraham. The covenant of Abraham is nested within the covenant of Noah. Now, think about this. God said that the covenant with Abraham would be everlasting. How could we know that it would be everlasting if we did not have the rainbow in the sky? Because the rainbow tells us that there will be an everlasting, right? The rainbow tells us that things are going to go on and on and on, and that God is not going to, in a whim, destroy us. And so Abraham, when God tells Abraham that this covenant is going to be everlasting, and Abraham wants to know how long is everlasting, what does he do? He looks up at the sky and sees the rainbow. And now he knows how long everlasting is. And so Abraham doesn't have to worry about his covenant being wiped out in a flood, because God has promised there would never be a flood again. So you see how this covenant is dependent upon this covenant. Okay. Well, this is important because as we go on, we're going to see another covenant. So let's look at the summary of the covenant, the Abrahamic covenant. The parties involved were God and Abraham. There's only two parties involved in this. Israel is not involved in this at this point. It's only God and Abraham. The purpose is to establish a people for God, which included the land, national identity, and the blessings. The covenant sign is circumcision. The duration is everlasting, forever. And the requirements was that God fulfill all the promises that He said He would do. And Abraham's responsibility was, at a certain point, to leave Ur of the Chaldees, go to the land, conceive a child through Sarah, and now, as extension, then, is to be circumcised and continue in obedience to a Torah. Because there again, as we saw when the covenant was passed on to Isaac, God said He made this covenant with Abraham because Abraham obeyed. So we could understand. It's implied that if Abraham had not been an obedient person, the covenant would have never been made, right? Okay. There have never been any violations on the part of Abraham or God to this covenant. So is the covenant still intact?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't find any violations to this covenant. And still a valid covenant? Yes, it's still a very valid covenant. Because God is, it's a unilateral covenant. God is the only one that can break the covenant. Abraham can't break the covenant. Okay, so this covenant was confirmed, and then it was passed on to his son Isaac in Genesis 26, verse 3. In fact, I'll just read that. It says, "Dwell in this land, and I will," this is speaking to Isaac, Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you, for to you and your descendants I give all these lands. I will perform the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And you see, in Isaac, he's not asking Isaac to do anything. He just tells Isaac, this is what I'm going to do. I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So all of these things were required of Abraham for the establishment of the covenant. But once the covenant was established, it's set, and now it can't be broken. But just because the covenant cannot be broken does not mean that everybody has to be a part of the covenant. For instance, Esau found little value in the covenant, right? Now, we could assume that Esau was circumcised as a child, but Esau never really saw enough value in the covenant to want to be a part of it. And so he basically sold off his portion in the covenant. But yet Jacob valued the covenant, and he wanted to be a part of it. And Jacob, later on in his life, conferred varying aspects of the covenant to his sons, you know, the 12 sons, especially Judah and Joseph. And then Joseph basically split the part of the covenant up that was conveyed to him and gave it to his two different sons. And then we know also that all 12 of Jacob's descendants wore the sign of the covenant. And we know that from Genesis 34:15. I didn't write that down. But you can look up Genesis 34:15. Oh, I know what it is. That's where the Dinah incident. That's the Dinah incident where the brothers said, let them be circumcised like we are. Okay? So we know that the descendants of Jacob were all circumcised. And then we know that all the Israelites down through the time up to the Exodus were also circumcised based on Joshua 5. So all of these people then found value in the covenant. And so even in Egypt, the people, even though the people sort of got off to the wrong way a lot of times while they're in slavery, they still held to the promise of the covenant by continuing to circumcise their children. Okay? So going on down to the story, we get to the Sinai covenant. And so, covenant of Mount Sinai. This covenant is sort of like the Abrahamic covenant in a way, in that it starts out as a parody type covenant, but this one clearly becomes a suzerain covenant. And in fact, you could say it's, when the covenant was made, it has the aspects of both right there from the beginning. Because God loved Israel. The whole purpose of bringing Israel out of Egypt was because of his love for Israel. And this is all parody in terms. And I would submit to you that when Israel went to Mount Sinai, God approached them as a husband, not as a king. Though he certainly was a king. But he went to them, and he the reason we would know that is because there's a lot of if type questions, you know. If you will do this, then I will do this. And so he looks at them as a future bride, and so he wants to enter into this parity covenant. But he also knows that because of the Exodus, Israel is a group of people who are going to be annihilated in Egypt if they're not taken care of. And Israel at this time, while they're in Egypt, are crying out to God, saying, great king, deliver us, deliver us. So this is the suzerainty aspect of it that we see in Israel being the vassal. So we see how both of these are coming together at the same time. Another thing about this Mount Sinai covenant is this is a new covenant. The covenant that's going to be made at Mount Sinai is a new covenant. It's not the same covenant as the covenant made with Abraham. Now,
It's based on the covenant made with Abraham, but it is a new, and we'll see that. It's a new covenant.
Is it within the circle?
Yeah, we'll see that too. It's a covenant that is obviously based on the covenant God made with Abraham. So let's look at the beginning of the covenant. It says, I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but my name, Jehovah, Yahweh, I was not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, where the Egyptians kept in whom the Egyptians have kept in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. So everything that God's getting ready to do to Egypt, for Israel, is based on what? A covenant. It's based on a covenant. And it's in a covenant that we're glad. Just like we're glad that the rainbow is in the sky, the Israelites are glad that they are under covenant. Because they know that if they're not under covenant, they have no deliverer. But they've got, they're under covenant, and thus they can depend on the person that they're in covenant with to come through for them. As we look at this covenant at Mount Sinai, oh man, I'm out of time. Can y'all bear with me 15 more minutes? Okay. As we look at this covenant, we see some things, and this is a slide that we had last time where we talked about the different aspects of a suzerain covenant. Part of a suzerain covenant is that there is a historical prologue in the covenant. And what that means is that when the suzerain was getting ready to enter into covenant with the vassal nation, what they would do is they would say, this is what I've done for you. I have done this. I have saved you from King Johash, or and I have invested in your nation, or I have done this, and I've done this, and I've done this. This is the historical prologue. And if you ever to go in the book of Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy is laid out exactly like this. This model for a suzerain covenant comes from the Hittite suzerain covenants we see. But if we look at the book of Deuteronomy, it is laid out just this way. Now, it may not be in that exact same order, but it has all these aspects in it. But part of this historical prologue, and if you go into the book of Deuteronomy and you start in chapter 1 and go down through around chapter 3, you're going to see God, or Moses is saying, this is what God has done for you. And he basically goes through history of what God has done for Israel. Well, in Exodus 19, we see the same thing. Exodus 19, God comes to Israel and says, have you seen how I have led you or have delivered you on eagle's wings? And he talks about all of the things he did. Now, we may not have thought about this, but what this is, this historical prologue, is basically a courting aspect of the treaty or the covenant. This is where the boy is going to the girl and saying, hey, you know, I can do this, and I beat up John, and I did all of these things, and so, you know, I'd really like for you to marry me. Well, see, what God did was this. He took them out of Egypt. He took and destroyed their enemies. He led them through the sea, and then he led them out to the wilderness. Well, you know, the wilderness experience we look at oftentimes as bad things that Israel did, but actually that's part of the courting process. Because look at the things that Egypt or that happened while they were in Egypt. Let me see where I'm at here. In the wilderness, what God did is he established himself as a light by night for them and a cloud for the day. He provided them warmth at night and a covering from the sun during the day. He held back the Egyptian army before they crossed the sea, or as they were crossing the sea. At Marah, he turned bitter waters into sweet waters that they could drink. He set quail out to satisfy their thirst, or their hunger. He sent bread from heaven for them. He caused water to gush out of a rock for them. And he destroyed the entire army of the Amalekites. And he did all of this in 50 days. This was done for the purpose of establishing himself as someone that could deliver them, as someone who could protect them. This is all courting. This is all what I can do for you guys. Now, obviously, there was some rebellion on their part. And, you know, any of us who've dated, we know that these girls always have this time when they sort of, you know. But this is the courting process. And so when God gets Israel to Mount Sinai, he can truly say, I've delivered you on eagle's wings. Now, will you marry me? And I would submit to you that there's no knight in shining armor that could ever do what God did for Israel in those 50 days. It was tremendous. Now, I heard a guy last night tell me that, or yesterday tell me that everybody should court for 1 year. So I don't know if there's a year-long courting process here, but 50 days was enough, I guess. In fact, at the end of this courting process, Israel was so awestruck and so Twitter-pated, you might say, that they were willing to do anything this guy said. And that's exactly what they did, because God said, in effect, if you will accept this covenant, then I will set you apart as a special treasure to me. And the people, before they ever heard the terms of the covenant, said, all you say we will do. They were enamored by him. And why not? Look at what all he had done. Now, keep in mind that we don't understand a lot of this stuff today because we don't live in those times. But in those times, these people knew exactly what was going on. And they knew what God was doing. And they knew that as part of a covenant type situation, things are going to be required of them. Because that's the way things were done. And they truly understood. So, as we go on, God proposed to Israel in Exodus 19. And then from Exodus 20 through 23, God puts stipulations into the covenant. This is where he adds the law. We might call it the ketubah, the wedding arrangement, or wedding agreement that Israel is making with God. This covenant was read, just as the, if we look back at that slide that had all of the model for the Hittite suzerain treaty, the covenant was read, which was required by that process. It was ratified by the cutting of the covenant and the sprinkling of the blood on the people. Now, obviously, all Israel did not walk between the parts. So what God did instead is he had Moses kill an animal, basically slit it in half. And God took half the blood and he sprinkled it on the people. And he took the other half of the blood and sprinkled it on the altar as a sign that both God, which was symbolized by the altar, and the people were all under covenant. So this is when the covenant was established. And then, of course, God had Moses go up the mountain and he had them, the tablets brought down. Okay. Now, remember, God established the covenant by the cutting of the animal and sprinkling the blood before the commandments were given, before the tablets were given. And I say this because there are people who will say that because those tablets were broken, the covenant ended. But no, those tablets were just simply tablets. And they had part of the law, part of the stipulations on them. We don't know exactly what all was on them. But because those tablets were broken, did not end the covenant. It just simply means the tablets were broken. Okay, so. It If we were to look at the laws given in Exodus 20 through 23, we're going to see a lot of these things that were that are required by the covenant stipulations. One was that there was a sign established. And what was the sign that was established between Exodus 20 and 23? Anybody know? The Sabbath. Okay. Now, God had already given them the Sabbath. But now he sets the Sabbath aside as a sign of the covenant. And he very clearly does. He says, this is a sign between you and me that you are my people. In other words, that I'm married to you. The Sabbath is the sign of the covenant. Quick one.
Our covenants always till death do you part.
Yes.
No matter what time.
Well, I would say in regards to the Bible, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the sign was given. The Sabbath sign was given. And also during this period from Exodus 20 through 23, God requires Israel to come up to hear the terms of the covenant reiterated on a regular basis. And that regular basis is the festivals. Okay. All right, so moving on, we come to the... Okay, the tablets are part of the covenant, but they are not the covenant. Okay, we've already said that. So we get to the golden calf incident, and the question here is, did the golden calf incident change or abrogate the covenant? And there again, there are people who believe that all of these things were processes along the way that destroyed the covenant. Well, the quick answer is no. And the reason why is because within the covenant terms that God had already given, He says, if you take and offer sacrifice to anyone but me, I'm not going to do away with the covenant. It says that person will be destroyed. So God had established within the covenant between, Exodus 22, this is before the actual ratification of the covenant, he establishes this and he says, okay, if you break my covenant by worshiping an image, then I am going to destroy that person, but that does not abrogate the covenant. All right? Now, so, let me see, where am I? The terms of the covenant were broken, but the covenant itself was not broken. The consequences of this type of behavior are spelled out in the covenant for the purpose of not having to destroy the covenant. So God puts these things within the covenant so that the covenant does not cease when due to bad behavior. And again, in a marriage covenant, we might say, if the husband makes a bad financial decision, then we're going to cut off his beer supply for 2 months. Okay? But that doesn't void the marriage. You see? That's I guess, in better terms, that's the way we could say it. All right. So as a result of the covenant, because the terms of the covenant said that people that do bad things in the covenant are going to be destroyed, specifically worshiping an image, it required people to die. And as a result, what happened? 3,000 people died, right? So the death of the 3,000 satisfied the terms of the covenant. So that the covenant is intact. The death of the 3,000 satisfied the terms of the covenant so that the covenant was intact. What does that tell us? It tells us a couple of things. One is that not everybody was involved in the sin of the golden calf. And that God does things in covenants. He's smart enough to devise a covenant, whereas the covenant does not have to be nullified due to the bad actions of the people who are involved in the covenant. Now, how do we know that the covenant continued on? We go on down to verse 34, chapter Exodus 34, verse 10, and he says, "Behold, I cut a covenant before all your people. I will do marvels." If you look at this, people will say, well, this is he's making a new covenant. But that's not the case because we don't see another cutting of the covenant. What we see is God saying, I have made a covenant. I had cut a covenant with you. And the covenant is still on. And not only that, I'm going to do greater things within the covenant now. And as we saw with Abraham, God added to the covenant as he went. Well, this is one of God's additions to the covenant. He's saying, I'm going to do marvels with you. The covenant's not off. In fact, I'm going to make an example out of you guys. And this is precisely what he did. By the way, he said this, Exodus 34, verse 10, he said this nearly a year after the golden calf incident. So they are still in covenant. The golden calf incident did not nullify the covenant. So now, from this point on, we want to look and say, is there anything else in the covenant or anything else that Israel did that nullified in any way this particular covenant? Because this actually, the covenant of Mount Sinai is actually the only covenant we see Israel going under. We don't see a cutting of any other covenant with Israel. And so did Israel in any way do anything to nullify the covenant to where there is no longer a covenant with Israel? Well, let's look at some of the objections and where people say that is. One of them is Deuteronomy 5, verses 2 and 3. And it says here, "The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, all of us who are here and alive this day." All right, this is 40 years down the road from the Mount Sinai. By this time, all of the people who were aged 20 years old or over, except for Aaron, Moses, Caleb, and Joshua, had died. All right, and God says, people will say that now God's making a new covenant with this younger group of people. But let's look at this and see exactly what it says. "The Lord made this covenant with our fathers," or "the Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us who are alive to this day." Well, who are the fathers that are being spoken of here? Yeah, the fathers are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The covenant at Horeb, or the covenant at Mount Sinai, was not made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was made with the children of Israel. So, this is clear enough explanation right here for me that this has nothing to do with establishing a new covenant. It's just simply saying that the covenant, Israel, that you're under is not the same covenant that they were under. Now, you are under their covenant, but this particular covenant requires obedience from you, whereas there's no obedience required of you in order to be under the Abrahamic covenant. Israel could enjoy the benefits of the covenant with the fathers. The covenant of Mount Sinai was dependent on Israel's continued obedience, unlike the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the ultimate establishment of the covenant with Israel was yet to be determined. In other words, at this point, they're under covenant. But remember, the covenant is a bilateral covenant. The blood was sprinkled on both parties, right? And so it's dependent on God doing his part and Israel doing their part for them to remain in covenant. But keep in mind, just like he did at the sin of the golden calf, God has stipulations in the covenant for rebellion within the covenant.
And this is talking about Mount Sinai.
This is Mount Sinai, right.
And Cam doesn't think that Jeremiah 31:31, Hebrews 8:8, where it talks about the new covenant, is the Hebrew word is not new. It's renewed, and that's the renewal of this Exodus 19 covenant.
We'll talk about that next time. All right, so this is one of the arguments that are given. And actually, to drive the point home that this is not a new covenant, what Moses does after this is he rereads the stipulations of the covenant. He goes through and reads them all over again. Now, there are some changes or additions to the covenant. And the reason for the additions is because this is another generation. This is not the same generation that came out of Mount Sinai. This is a new generation, and there were things that they weren't aware of. Okay, one of the things that's talked about here is circumcision. Well, why would we talk about circumcision again? Because they weren't circumcised. They weren't circumcised while they're in the wilderness, and so we see a discussion again of circumcision. This is another place where it says, where people would tend to think that the covenant was done away with. Deuteronomy 29, these are the words of the covenant which Yahweh and Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant he made with them. Let me read this in the Tanakh. It makes a little bit more sense. It says, these are the terms of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to conclude with the Israelites in the land of Moab, in addition to the covenant he made with them at Horeb. Well, what this is saying is that there are additions. Like I said earlier, there are additions now that are required of the Israelites at this time that were not necessarily a part of the previous covenant, because in the previous covenant, they came out as a circumcised people. These people here are not circumcised at this point. And so there are things that they have to do. Let me see if I had some written down here. Oh, okay. As part of them not being circumcised, we sometimes wonder, why were they not circumcised when they were in the wilderness? And I would submit to you the reason is because when they refused to go into the land, then God said, you're going to die in the wilderness, right? All right. I would say that the children of Israel that refused to go in the land lost faith in God and thus lost faith in the covenant that God had made with them. And therefore, because they felt like they were no longer under covenant, they failed to perform their responsibilities of the covenant, which included circumcising their children. Remember, failure to be circumcised at age 8 is not the sin of the child. It's the sin of the father. So the people had rebelled. They had completely rebelled against God, even to the point of forsaking the covenant, just like Esau had forsaken the covenant. And so when they got down to the time of Deuteronomy at the end here, when they're getting ready to go in the land, they had to be brought back up to speed on all of this stuff. We know that they didn't keep the festivals during the time in the wilderness. We know that from Joshua, that they had not kept Passover. You know, there's all kinds of things that we realize that in the wilderness they didn't do a lot of the things that God had required of them. In fact, in Deuteronomy we see over and over and over again God saying, when you come into the land, then you start doing these things. Okay, because that's when the covenant is reestablished. Or not, let me take that back. The covenant is already established, but this is when they begin to start walking in the covenant once again. Kathy?
How early do you think they were given Leviticus? Leviticus 23, where all the festivals
were listed. Leviticus was given there while they're still at Mount Sinai.
Okay.
Because that's where the sacrifices were
given. Even though they were given those days, that early on, they didn't keep them the
whole time. I would submit to you they did not. All right, so as we go on here, there are some interesting things that are said about Israel and the covenant relationship God has with them. Leviticus 26:44, yet even then, because let's go back, what is Leviticus 26 about? It's the blessings and the curses, right? And God says, if you walk in my way, I'm going to bless you, but if you don't, I'm going to curse you. He doesn't say, I'm going to drive you out of the covenant, or you will no longer be under covenant. He simply says, I will curse you. And then he says, yet even then, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them or spurn them as to destroy them, annulling my covenant with them, for I am Yahweh, their God. God is saying, I am not going to annul this covenant, even if they reject me. I'm going to annul this covenant that I've made with them. So God has made these stipulations. And the stipulations that God established in the covenant with Israel was that if you reject me, I'm going to scatter you, not destroy you. You'll be scattered. But every time we see a discussion of the scattering of God's people, Israel, what do we see right after that? A restoration. A drawing them back at the end time. So the covenant then, there's really nothing that God, that Israel could do at this point to actually get out of the covenant, because God had built these stipulations in the covenant that that prohibited the covenant from being annulled due to disobedience. Yes, Kath?
Okay. Where exactly does it say that they will be scattered?
Oh, it's in Deuteronomy. It's Leviticus 26, 27, and Deuteronomy 28 and 29. Okay, so now we look at the covenant relationship here. And we see that we have this covenant with Israel. And what is the covenant of Israel dependent upon? The covenant with Abraham. And what's the covenant with Abraham dependent on? The covenant with Noah. So all of these covenants are dependent upon a previous covenant. You see that? So, I'm going to leave us with that. We're going to go through the summary first. Let's do the summary. Let's look at the Mount Sinai, the summary of the Mount Sinai covenant. The parties involved are God and Israel. And as far as Israel is concerned, it was, remember it said, to you and those who are not yet with us. So to future generations it goes to. The purpose was to establish a covenant, to establish the covenant made with Abraham. The purpose of the covenant God made with Israel was to fulfill the covenant God made with Abraham. The covenant sign is the Sabbath. The duration is forever, because he says this will be an everlasting covenant. I didn't cover that, but this is one of the things God says about this covenant. The requirements are is that God established Israel as the heirs of the covenant, and on Israel's part, they were to keep the Torah. This is all that God is requiring of Israel, is to keep the Torah. The violations, there are many violations on the part of Israel. But remember, God made stipulations within the covenant to deal with violations, so that violations did not destroy the covenant. And is it still valid? Yes, it's still valid, even for a scattered people, because there again, the stipulations were in the covenant. In the covenant, whereas that you would be scattered for disobedience, not that you would be destroyed for disobedience, but you would be scattered for disobedience. So, with that, that's the end. The next part we're going to deal with then is going to be the new covenant. Now, when you look, just a little hint, when you look at this, if there is a new covenant, what does the new covenant have to be nested in? The old covenant. Okay? So, sorry about going over.